Before we get to all the hockey questions, I do want to just find out, you know, based on the situation we're sitting in, how are you? How is your family right now?
We're doing well. It's obviously it's been a tough time for everybody worldwide, not just the people in New York, but obviously New York's been hit the hardest. But you know, we were in Colorado when this all happened, and we're supposed to fly to Arizona the next day, but obviously we got rerouted back here to New York, and we landed out in Westchester, and I've been holed up here in Westchester ever since we landed on, I think it was the 12th of March. So obviously a difficult time worldwide, and but it's just amazing to watch how the world and Americans in general and Canadians join together to unite and fight something this serious.
Before Berkey gets to some hockey questions, we obviously want to talk to you about the exceptional season put forward by the Rangers. You talked about being in Westchester in New York, and we're all sitting there watching the news, and we know that's the epicenter of everything going on right now. Can you just give us a little description of what it's like there to be in, you know, really the epicenter of where this pandemic's hit hardest in North America? What's that been like?
Yeah, it's it's scary once the whole thing went down and you see the impact it had throughout our city. And, you know, I can think over half the cases in America right here in New York. And, you know, it spread pretty quickly in the state, in particular in the city. And, you know, but like I said, just to watch the way the state and the city responded and how people unified and how people did everything they could to help each other, I think it's really minimized the death toll, and it's certainly not minimizing the people that have passed. But, you know, this thing could be a lot worse if people hadn't bonded together and united and done everything they could to slow this thing down. And but it has been an eerie feeling throughout the state of New York, in particular the city. I've only been to the city once to swing by my apartment to pick something up. But, I mean, it's really a ghost town, and it's unlike anything you've seen in the city of New York.
Berkey?
Yeah. Hey, David, how are you?
Berkey, how are you?
I'm good. So we've been asking the coaches to come on, and we're not going to beat this to death, but we want to track your path to the NHL as a coach. We found it interesting. We talked to Torts. His first head coaching job in pro was coaching Virginia in the Atlantic Coast League. Talked to Sully, talked to guys. Guys have followed different paths. Now, you were a high draft pick yourself, but you started 5 years as an associate coach at BU, right?
My first coaching job was actually in
Alaska, right? Northeastern? Yep.
Northeastern, yeah. Ben Smith, who actually recruited me to go to BU, and I remained we had a great friendship and still do to this day. After I had to stop playing, he was somebody I really leaned on, and it was really one of the reasons I got into coaching after, you know, when you're diagnosed with hemophilia at the age of 20 and your career stops. You're kind of looking for support, and not only did my family give me an abundance of support, but my coaches were people that I really leaned on, you know, whether it be Ben Smith or Jack Parker or Larry Piatelli, my coach at Kent.
Let me interrupt you, David. Tell people, I didn't know if you wanted to talk about your illness or not. Tell people why your playing career ended.
Yeah, I was, it's funny, you know, during my time at Kent, I started getting hurt a lot, and, you know, I played football, played hockey, baseball, and you know, as my junior year started progressing, I was starting to get a lot of injuries, and most of them were bruising. You know, a game would end, and, you know, all of a sudden I'd have some swelling, whether it be in my ankle or my thigh or my arm. And, you know, I just thought, hey, I'm playing football, I'm playing hockey, these things happen. Then I got to my senior year at Kent, and for some reason I was getting hurt more often than ever. And, you know, one of the things that when I was younger, I was bigger than everybody. You know, when I got to Kent as a 15-year-old, I was 6 feet, 215 pounds. So, you know, when you're playing against smaller people, maybe you're not putting yourself in harm's way as often as you would be when you're playing against bigger people. But, you know, my situation really got magnified when I got to BU. And, you know, I missed half my freshman year. I had a bleeding into my leg that required emergency surgery, missed half the season. My sophomore year at BU, I was relatively healthy. I only missed two games. But still, I was having a lot of issues, a lot of injuries, and I'll never forget this. We had won the hockey championship, and Dr. Leach came up to me in the locker room after the game, and I had missed the first two games of the playoffs, the only two games I missed a year. I had bleeding into my thigh, and, you know, I had trouble walking and whatnot, so I couldn't really skate, so they held me out for the two games, and we ended up winning the hockey championship. And I'll never forget Dr. Leach saying to me, in the midst of the celebration in the locker room, you know, I want you to get your blood checked. He said, every injury you've had has been blood-related. Our season ended. We got knocked out of the national tournament by Minnesota and Minnesota Gophers. And then the next day, the North Stars called me and wanted to sign me. And but back then, you couldn't sign an NHL contract. and play in the Olympics. And I really wanted to play in the 88 Olympics. But still, there was some decision to make. But the next day, I went and got my blood checked. I went to a hematologist. I didn't even know what a hematologist was. I went to the hematologist. 2 days later, I go to sit down with Jack Parker to talk about, you know, what I was going to do, whether I was going to sign or whether I was going to stay at BU. And I was probably going to stay. And when I walked in, the team doctor was there. And when I walked in, he said that my blood test came back and I was a hemophiliac, which is a blood clotting disorder, meaning when, you know, if you and I get hit with the same amount of force, I would bleed a lot longer internally than you would. Your bruise would be very minimal, where mine would be a lot more exasperated and exaggerated. So, you know, they were shocked that I was able to play hockey even through, you know, through the age of 20. I had had it my whole life. I was born with it. And my career ended then. And, you know, I was able to play a couple of years, but, you know, I had some major surgery. I lost some movement on my right foot. That was really the end of it for me. And, you know, like I said, I mean, coaching was something that I always had an eye on, especially after that had happened to me. And, because I just knew the impact that my coaches has had on me and allowing me to fight through a very, very difficult time. And I thought to myself, what a great opportunity where if I could ever get into coaching and hopefully someday have that type of impact and help a player along the way my coaches did for me. And, you know, I can't thank Ben Smith enough for giving me that first opportunity at Northeastern.
So I saw you play your draft year. I wanted to see you play at Melton Academy. Remember how cold that rink was?
Every prep school rink was cold, but that was right.
It was like they could have hung meat up on the side of the walls there. So go to Northeastern. Yeah. You go to Northeastern with Ben, then you go to Omaha, Nebraska, University of Omaha, Nebraska.
Yep.
And then
yep.
you come back to BU, associate head coach with Jackie.
No, and then I got my first head coaching job was with the U.S. National Program. I coached the under-17 team. So I left Nebraska, Omaha. I was there for 6 years. It was an incredible opportunity to start a program. When I left Northeastern, Ben actually became the 98 Women's Olympic coach. So he was leaving Northeastern, and then Mike Kemp had got the job in Nebraska, Omaha. They were just starting their Division I program. And, Mike, I was actually coaching the 15 festival up in Lake Placid, and Dave Peterson, the Olympic coach for the 88 and 92 U.S. team, was a good friend of mine, and Mike Kemp had just got the job. And the night before, Mike walks into the rink and says to Dave Pearson, I just got the Nebraska-Omaha job. He said, oh, congratulations. He said, now I got to find an assistant coach. And I was on the bench coaching the game they were watching, and Dave Pearson turned to Mike Kemp and said, well, there's your assistant coach right there. So that worked out. I moved to Omaha, Nebraska, which I never thought I would do, but it was an incredible time and great six great years. You know, to build a program was a really unique challenge, and it really established, for me anyway, a lot of recruiting bases and a lot of recruiting contacts in the hockey world. And just really, to go out west, you know, being a, you know, Boston, Rhode Island guy and going out west was the best move for me because it certainly opened up a ton of doors. And then I became the head coach for the under-17 team up in Ann Arbor, the U.S. National Program, for 2 years. And then I went to Jack to BU to be the associate head coach at BU.
Okay, we're there 5 years. And then again, we'll get through this quickly here because I know some people are fascinated by it. I am. But we want to talk about your Rangers, too. So then sidestep to Cleveland. You go to Cleveland for 2 years.
Yeah, we had just won the national championship in 2009. Yeah, we just won the national championship in 2009. And, I was 43 at the time, and Jack was 67, 68. I remember when Jack hired me, he said, 3 or 5 more years, that's it. I'm only going to coach here. And if you do the job I think you're going to do, you'll replace me here at BU. Well, that was the fifth year, and we had just won the national title. And I remember me talking to Jack after, and I knew he wasn't going anywhere. And we had three Colorado draft picks on our team. We had Kevin Shattenkirk, Colby Cohen, Brandon Yip, actually, and Karen Millan. We had four. So I'd got to know Craig Billington very well. He was the director of player development for the Avalanche. And about 4 days after I talked to Jack, I get a phone call from Craig Billington saying, Joe Sacco is going to be named the head coach of the Avalanche tomorrow. We want to name you the head coach in Lake Erie. And we want an answer in 24 hours. That's how fast it happened. And, you know, I just thought to myself, you know, 43 years old, what an incredible opportunity to be a head coach in the American Hockey League. The hard part was I was taking a big pay cut. I was taking a 50% pay cut leaving BU, going to the American League. But I thought to myself, it was, you know, I was going to find out whether I could coach or not. That, to me, I thought, you know, you got to take chances on yourself. You got to invest in yourself. And, you know, I became the head coach in the American League, and it was the best move I ever made.
And we've asked a few guys, what did you make in Cleveland all those years ago?
I made $100,000 in Cleveland my first year.
That's a big pay cut from associate coach at BU for sure.
Yeah, I was, well, you know, 43. It's not like I was 28, 35 years old where I could maybe, you know, I made 160 that last year at BU, and I was taking a $60,000 pay cut, which was, like I said, it was a big investment. But I thought, you know, if I go and do the job I think I can do, I'll either prove I can coach or not. It'll open up a lot of doors. And, I actually did a seminar for the NHL Coaches Association this February, and that's one of the things I said is to young coaches, don't be afraid to invest in yourself.
Well, so then you go back 5 years as head coach at BU, have a lot of success. Talk about the philosophy of the 1 and 2 year players that BU seems to get, these top picks that are there for just 1 or 2 years. Different psychology, isn't it?
It sure is. It really is it's a balancing act, and you've got to, you know, when I first got there, I thought, let's go get all the best players and all the, and, you know, all of a sudden you win draft day. I jokingly used to say, you know, winning draft day as a college coach isn't necessarily the best thing for your program because, you know, these guys aren't going to stay very long. But, you know, one of the things I think that you need to do is you need to have great communication with the NHL team. They need to feel comfortable keeping their players there, knowing they're going to get better. I know a lot of coaches sometimes get a little protective of their players, but I just don't buy that approach. I think that, you know, when an organization drafts a player, they want him to be the best player that he can be. And when I was at BU, we wanted him to be the best player he can be. And if you can work together and you have the best interest of the player at heart, the player's going to get better quicker, and we're all going to get what we want out of it. But that being said, you got to be careful because you need seniors to be successful in college hockey. And one of the things that we faced in my 5 years at BU, we never had a lot of seniors. And, you know, we were always right there. We were always, you know, I mean, I think 3 out of 5 years we went to the Elite Eight. 1 year we went to the national championship game. And I know you were happy with that outcome, Brooke. You and your Friars beat us in the finals.
I love that game.
But it really is a balancing act. But, you know, I just it's such a great challenge, and it's really good for your program when you get the, you know, the Eichels, the McAvoys, the Kellers, the Greenways, you know, the Fabros. And, you know, when I was the assistant, we had Shattenkirk and Wilson and Bonino and guys like the Gilroy, guys like that. You know, it really puts your program at center stage in the hockey world.
And we've seen a new trend here, David. The fifth coach to go from the NCAA to the NHL. So it's becoming a bit of a more regular leap for coaches to make that jump. And you're showing the success of the NHL, I'm sure, blazing a trail for guys in the future to jump in as well to do the same thing that you did. Justin, do you have any questions regarding the Rangers and what David Quinn did there?
Well, yeah, you know, just hearing the path, and I'm really just intrigued, too, by the sort of the journey of it. I wonder if by the time you got to be the head coach of the New York Rangers, are there moments where you're there, you know, you guys have been great since you've been there. Well, not great since you've been there, but you've turned the corner, and now you guys are showing some real promise. Have there been moments of being starstruck, of being in New York City, of like, holy crap, I'm the coach of the Rangers, or is it just business as usual, another coaching job?
It's funny you say that, Justin, because when I'm actually coaching and you're in, I tell this to coaches that ask about what it's like. I don't feel any different than when I was coaching in Ann Arbor, Nebraska, Omaha, Cleveland. It's hockey. You're dealing with people. You're coaching hockey. You know, you got to handle, obviously you got to handle the players different, but regardless of where you're coaching, you have to handle your players different everywhere. You know, within the roster, you got to handle your players different. So, you know, it's the same recipe for success. It's, you know, having your team prepared, establishing a work ethic, having a connection to your players, and getting them to play to the best of their ability. That being said, every day there's a moment that goes by that I'm walking around, or whether I'm walking in MSG, and I just look, I can't believe I'm coaching the New York Bleeding Rangers. You know, I mean, that's just the reality, you know. I mean, but I felt that way when I was at BU. I remember, you know, every day at one point in time, I felt BU was at, you know, I was not that grand a stage, but in the college hockey world, how the hell did I become the head coach at BU? You know, I mean, it was I've been incredibly fortunate in my coaching career.
My first day as the GM of the Toronto Maple Leafs, I went down to work out, and I caught myself. I was putting on the Maple Leaf logo, and I caught myself and did a double take. And Tim Hunter noticed.
You know what it's like, Percy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's real.
Assistant coach noticed. Tim Hunter noticed. Yeah. He goes, yeah, it's a little different, isn't it? This is a little different than the Vancouver Canucks.
Yes, it is. It's an original six, and it really, I, like I said, I, every day I say to myself, I, you know, I can't believe I'm coaching the New York Rangers. It's an incredible, incredible opportunity.
David, before we let you go, I got to ask you, there was one really special moment that stands out to this Rangers season, at least for an individual effort, and that was Mika Zibanejad's five-goal game. What do you remember most about that and how it unfolded and how the team and the fans reacted?
I'm telling you, it was so electric in that building that night. And I think, you know, regardless of what was going to happen, you know, what went on the last 6-7 weeks for us was so important in our development as an organization and where we want to get to. And, you know, Mika Zibanejad, I was telling everybody when I took this job a year ago after I started coaching, I don't know if people realize how good this guy is. And, you know, we're so fortunate that, you know, our two-star players, and we've got a lot of good ones, but two guys that have obviously separated themselves have been Mika Zibanejad and obviously Artemi Panarin. And what makes it all so exciting is the type of people they are. And but one thing you remember about that night is that the game, not only did he score five goals, but in a game of that impact, with that atmosphere against the Washington Capitals, with our season on the line every night when you're in that playoff push, you know, he scores a goal every which way possible. You know, he scores at the end, you know, with a minute and a half to go to make it 5-4, and the roof almost blows off the building. And then, of course, Ovechkin ties it. And then 30 seconds into overtime, Panarin makes an unbelievable pass to Mika, and he gets the fifth. And, you know, I wasn't there, but it was amazing to listen to the people that have been around the Rangers for a while. They hadn't heard that building that loud since, I think it was 2015, when in Game 7, when they beat, I think it was Washington, to go to the Eastern Conference Final, Game 7 overtime. I think Stepan scored the overtime winner in Game 7 at the Garden. You know, whether it would be Mark Stahl or Hank or those guys, they would say that they had never heard the building that loud since that night. So,
Quinny, we'll argue this over a beer sometime on why he was on the ice when Ovechkin scored, for God's sake.
It's a pet peeve of Berkey's.
How do you say that, Berkey? I should have called a freaking timeout is what I
said. I can't stand coaches not using their timeouts, and I can't stand them and put star players on the ice to try and empty their goals. Drives me nuts.
Well, he's a good defensive player, too, so I got to put him out there.
He's got the longest stick on your team, too.
He sure does. And he's a hell of a player. And he just, but the night, the magnet, you know, the five goals, but it wasn't a 7-2 win. And this guy scores five goals against the Washington Capitals in a game of that magnitude. It was just an incredible night, and just so happy for him, and obviously a huge 2 points for us that night.